Chapter 13. The Counteroffensive. "We and others are looking at our own specimens and trying to confirm it," he said, adding, "If we validate it, great. My expectation is that we will not." Dr. William Reeves. 4 days after the Science article lit up the media, the ME/CFS director at the CDC, William Reeves, publicly dismissed the idea of a retroviral association with ME/CFS and broadcast a damning prophecy in the New York Times, saying his team did not expect to validate the XMRV findings. They had not performed a single experiment, and moreover had attended the July 22nd meeting, worked with the samples, and found no issues with the Mikovits team's research findings. Patients with ME/CFS had grown weary of William Reeves's decades-long claim that their symptoms were psychological. Around the time of the October 2009 Science publication, Reeves may have been working on his research that was later published the following July in his co-authored paper, Personality Features and Personality Disorders in Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, a population-based study, which concluded that CFS is associated with an increased prevalence of maladaptive personality features and personality disorders. This might be associated with being non-compliant with treatment suggestions, displaying unhealthy behavioral strategies, and lacking a stable social environment. Reeves had taken over the NIH's ME/CFS program from Dr. Steven Strauss, a physician turned virologist, who was also quoted in the New York Times in 2001, 8 years before the Science publication, on his belief that what's important about CFS is many people get over it. Individuals who have it for many years lose hope. They then take on a series of maladaptive behaviors, which sustain their illness because they become so focused and so phobic. They avoid exercise, disrupt their sleep patterns. It gets harder and harder for them to regain normalcy. Patients had to wonder what these government heads would consider an adaptive, as opposed to a maladaptive, set of illness behaviors, when most of them expressed a relentless wish to deal positively with hardship by seeking out social networks, downgrading to new hobbies that matched their limited abilities, and pursuing medical care that might help them get their lives back. One patient in an ME/CFS support group was told by her admiring doctor, "You're not depressed enough, given what you're dealing with." Andrea Whittemore's picture appeared with the New York Times article, quoting Reeves. She was leaning on a couch, still youthful, but with a drawn, pale face, a pretty blue blouse hugging her thin frame, her blonde hair and makeup styled, with her right arm crooked across a pillow and her head almost leaning against her hand. The last detail was not lost on ME/CFS patients, who joked about their alternate reality to that of the uprights, people who could stand up easily without propping themselves on something. An oxygen tube curled from the lower edge of the picture up to the nasal cannula peeking out from Andrea's pert nose. At 31, she had been sick for 19 years. She looked directly into the camera as if to say, "I'm here. I exist." The New York Times summarized the history of the disorder well, but impersonally. It seemed to describe a natural oddity rather than conveying the horror of a tragic, devastating affliction for millions around the world. ME/CFS was so destructive that patient communities had gone decades without the physical ability to arrange large protest marches on the Washington Mall. It was hard to stand up and demand your rights when standing itself often presented many challenges. The journal Nature gave the isolation and association of XMRV with ME/CFS some positive press, although it also covered the position of William Reeves. Nature published their XMRV article October 8, 2009, in coordination with the article in Science, adding additional information on further research efforts that had gone on since the May 23, 2009 submission. They noted that the authors detected XMRV in the immune cells of 67% of the ME/CFS patients, but in only 3.7% of healthy controls, and that the authors showed that the virus was able to spread from infected immune cells to cultured prostate cancer cells. They also noted the authors' finding that the virus's DNA sequence was more than 99% similar to the sequence of the virus associated with prostate cancer. Mikovits believed the association between XMRV and ME/CFS may have been even stronger than her team's work indicated. She wanted to study ME/CFS exposure to the virus more broadly. In an unpublished investigation, she and her colleagues analyzed blood cells in about 330 ME/CFS patients and found that more than 95% had evidence of XMRV infection, whereas only about 4% of healthy controls did. While the Nature article quoted the negative prediction from Reeves, it also ended with comments from Coffin, who was still then very supportive of the XMRV research. The Tufts University virologist who had studied MLV, mouse leukemia virus, pointed out that the XMRV virus's prevalence in healthy controls is in some ways an equally striking result. It's highly preliminary, but if it's in fact representative, then there are 10 million Americans with this infection, which is very similar to MLV and is now linked to two important diseases. Coffin added, "There's a lot we don't know, including whether XMRV causes disease, but that's always the case when the first paper, like this one, comes out." Overall, the early press coverage was positive, but there were hints that the battle ahead would be more brutal than anyone imagined. The night of the publication, Mikovits and her team gathered at the Whittemore Mansion. It was fall in the Sierras, with mild, sunny Reno days dropping to near freezing at night. The first winter storms expected to dump snow on the high mountain passes were only a few weeks away. But the Whittemore Mansion was warm and inviting, and Harvey and Annette had, in their usual gracious style of hosting, made sure there was enough food and drink for everybody. Mikovits, Peterson, Lombardi, University President Milt Glick, and their research staff, including Katie Hagen and Max Post, were present, along with other dignitaries. Harvey knew which news shows would be covering the XMRV story, and the group watched in rapt silence as the screen displayed pictures of their lab and interviews with Mikovits and other scientists commenting on the work. The attendees felt like they were part of a pivotal moment in science history, like NASA employees at a private showing of the moon landing. The British Broadcasting Corporation, BBC, wanted to hold the first live interview with the researchers for their morning radio show UK Radio 5 Live with Nikki Campbell and Sheila Fogarty on October 9, 2009. Since the interview would start at around midnight Nevada time due to the time difference, the group was tired but a little wired. England was home to several academic researchers who believed ME/CFS was nothing more than mass hysteria, including psychiatrist Simon Wesley, who had taken to calling the disorder a functional somatic syndrome, which was simply mass hysteria under another name. It was a little like calling a woman a daily serial monogamist with a rotating list of intimate partners rather than a tramp. They were still calling the patients crazy, but with just a bit more discretion. The derogatory view of the illness, typically called myalgic encephalomyelitis, ME, in England, had apparently infected the BBC radio hosts, and their tone became patronizing. The host mocked patients, and by extension the researchers, as mentally unstable. Hagen retorted by addressing them in a faux British accent like a chiding nanny, and when the BBC team realized they were being laughed at, they cut away to the weather. Mikovits observed that Annette seemed to disapprove of Hagen's antics, but the rest of the team enjoyed the comic relief. The Mikovits team found rousing support at home. The Whittemores hosted Rossetti and Mikovits and her fellow researchers at their skybox suite at the University of Nevada, Reno's Mackey Stadium for a football game by the team and its fanatical fans known as the Wolfpack. Mikovits enjoyed watching the Wolfpack take on adversaries from the awesome view in the skybox. University President Milt Glick often dropped by to say hello. "Hey, Judy, turn around," said Harvey eagerly during the halftime show. On the Jumbotron was a tribute to Mikovits and Annette Whittemore for the publication in Science. The scroll noted that this was only the second time in the university's history that an article from their school had been published in the prestigious journal. 30,000 fans of the Wolfpack roared their approval, sports fans cheering on Science. Glick smiled and shook Mikovits's hand, offering congratulations. It was a banner moment for all of them, a good game, good company, and football fans unexpectedly showering love for their scientific accomplishments. Within a few weeks of publication, the research team began receiving letters forwarded by Science from researchers, including one from a group at the British Medical Journal inquiring about their patient selection. The group seemed critical of the attempt to find a cause behind the disorder, without having a good handle on the virology. The editors of Science often gave the Mikovits team just 24 hours to draft a response, which meant everybody had to drop everything they were doing to respond. An email exchange between the senior editor at Science and Mikovits on January 5, 2010, revealed the decaying nature of their relationship. The letter referred to their response as carelessly prepared, and that the reader should come away knowing exactly what criteria you used for CFS diagnosis and who exactly were studied as healthy controls and how many controls were studied. The senior editor added, "If you cannot send us a clear, informative, and polished response, I'm afraid we will have no choice but to publish the technical comments on their own without a response from you." The carelessly prepared document and accompanying material sent to Science in response to questions raised by Lloyd, Sudlow, and Vandermeer reads in part, "In our recent publication in Science, 1, we analyzed blood cells from a patient population with a clinical diagnosis of chronic fatigue syndrome, CFS, and found that sequences encoding the human retrovirus XMRV were present in 67%, 68 of 101, of the patients, but in only 3.7%, 8 of 218, of healthy individuals. Our observation of actively replicating virus, as well as antibodies directed against XMRV in this CFS patient population, strengthened the hypothesis that this virus, which has also been detected in a subset of prostate cancers, 2, 3, is a human pathogen. Clinically, CFS is a heterogeneous syndrome, and its diagnosis is based on the exclusion of other diseases. Thus, the criteria used for the diagnosis of CFS varies greatly. All patient samples included in our study were diagnosed by a licensed physician using the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, criteria that diagnosis of CFS requires that an individual have persistent and relapsing fatigue for 6 months. All other known medical conditions had been excluded. The patients included in our study all met at least 4 of the 8 criteria defined by the CDC, 4, as a prerequisite for CFS diagnosis: tender axillary lymph nodes, sore throat, significantly impaired cognition and short-term memory, muscle pain, multi-joint pain, new headaches, unrefreshing sleep, and post-exertional malaise lasting more than 23 hours. The patient samples used in the present study were not selected with any bias other than a clinical diagnosis of CFS. The CFS patients were from the United States. Blood samples were drawn from patients in 2006 to 2009 from 35 patients identified in the 1984 to 1988 CFS outbreak in Incline Village, Nevada. 15 sporadic cases came from upstate New York. 15 sporadic cases from North Carolina and Florida. 36 diverse cases from Western United States, Canada, Australia, and Ireland. Inclusion in the study was based on a diagnosis of CFS which met the CDC and Canadian consensus diagnosis of CFS regardless of severity. The study population was 67% female, reflecting the gender incidence of CFS, and the age distribution was 19 to 75 years of age with a mean of 55. The control population of 320 was from samples drawn from healthy people visiting doctor's offices in the western United States. These samples were used as controls for the PCR studies. The healthy controls used in the study were representative of the at-risk population, that is, zip code matched as well as age and gender matched. For both patients and controls, peripheral blood mononuclear cells were collected from heparinized blood and aliquoted into four samples, RNA, DNA, protein plasma, and DMSO freeze for culture later. Samples were prepared within 6 hours of blood draw and frozen immediately in negative 80 degrees Celsius or liquid nitrogen. Blood was drawn from the patients and controls at least two different time points within 3 months of each other. For a 24-hour turnaround requested by science, the researchers believed it was a thorough job, with very minor editing mistakes. In the third paragraph, the team should have written that the CFS patients were mainly from the United States, although the sentences following that one detailed the country of origin for each sample. There was also some confusion over the number of control samples, whether it was 320 or 218. The quick answer was that the original number of controls provided by the lab was 320, but when trying to age and gender match the samples, this number was winnowed down to 218. These were not grievous errors given their quick reply and easily correctable. The increasingly scrutinizing attitude by the senior editor at Science was all the more puzzling to Mikovits and her team, since their paper was probably one of the most thoroughly vetted papers ever published by the journal. It had not only undergone peer review, but was the subject of an all-day pre-publication conference of the world's leading experts on retrovirology, as well as the focus of another, smaller conference attended by Frank Rossetti a month earlier, almost a scientific hazing atop a peer review. Mikovits reached out to a leading immunologist and advisor for the WPI on the paper and the antibody assay. She'd relayed her suspicion that Science would begin attacking the research because of the way they were handling the letters of complaint. So when the critical letter came from Science, Dr. Mikovits forwarded it to the advisor with the declaration, "Right on cue." He emailed back barely an hour after Mikovits had received the email from Science and told her to clarify the writing and numbers, stick to what is in the paper. It was good advice, and Mikovits followed it. The first negative study was published in the open-access journal PLOS-1. Public Library of Science, and involved researchers from England long associated with a psychiatric explanation for ME/CFS, such as the previously mentioned Simon Wesley, who preferred to call ME/CFS a functional somatic syndrome rather than mass hysteria. The Wesley research was even partially funded by the South London and Maudsley NHS Foundation Trust and Institute of Psychiatry, National Institute of Health Biomedical Research Center. Compared to those for science, the standards for publication in PLOS 1 were relaxed. The work of Mikovits and her team was submitted to Science on May 4, 2009. The referee comments were received June 6, a resubmission made in early July, an NIH conference held to discuss the findings in late July, an official acceptance issued on August 31st, followed by more than a month of editing, during which a full third of the paper was cut, and it was not published until October 8, 2009, 5 months after the initial submission. In stark contrast to this lengthy review process, the first negative study on XMRV was submitted on Tuesday, December 1, 2009, and accepted and published by PLOS-1 on Friday, December 4, 2009, somewhere around 72 hours. Within just a couple more months, another negative paper on XMRV and ME/CFS was published in Retrovirology in February 2010. It was also from the United Kingdom, from the laboratory of Dr. Kate Bishop. Bishop and her team studied two cohorts of ME/CFS patients from the UK to look for the presence of viral nucleic acids by using a PCR assay for XMRV GAG gene and the presence of serological responses using a viral neutralization. No association was found in that study between XMRV and CFS, while considerable cross-reactivity was found in the serological assay. The next negative paper came from the Netherlands and used samples that had been gathered from patients between December 1991 and April 1992. It was published in the British Medical Journal. The method the Dutch used was a real-time polymerase chain reaction assay targeting the XMRV integrase gene and/or a nested polymerase chain reaction targeting the XMRV GAG gene. The researchers found no XMRV sequences in any of the patients or controls in either of the assays. The authors noted in their conclusion, "We found no evidence for a role of XMRV in the cause of CFS in Dutch patients." Over the past decades, we have seen a series of papers prematurely claiming the discovery of the microbial cause of CFS. Regrettably, thus far, none of these claims have been substantiated. Mikovits was particularly concerned about the last paper, since her team had established a collaborative research agreement with the Netherlands researchers. The Netherlands group had, in fact, found positives, and Mikovits's team confirmed the positives, but when the paper was published, there was no mention of the positive samples. The researchers never reported their positive findings because they had altered their PCR procedures to make the assay more stringent, less likely to pick up closely related virus strains or non-specific results, thus narrowing the probability of any positives. Mikovits considered this scientific selectivity to be unfair. It was the relaxed stringency which had allowed the retrovirus to be identified in the first place. They didn't have a good handle on what it was, but they knew what was close to it. Mikovits believed the best way to characterize these three studies was to say that they were unable to find XMRV in those with ME/CFS or healthy controls using Silverman's VP62 plasmid as the gold standard. This was frustrating to Mikovits, as she had given several slide presentations around the world and said specifically that researchers needed to be looking for more than the VP62 sequence, because there could be others. It was time for Mikovits and her team to mount their response. Mikovits and her team addressed the challenge of responding to the negative studies, as well as some positive findings that had come out in the research literature. Their response paper was entitled, distribution of xenotropic murine leukemia virus-related virus, XMRV, infection in chronic fatigue syndrome and prostate cancer, and was soon published in the AIDS Review, a venue where researchers had already endured a complicated and conflict-laden history around HIV. The explanation for the negative studies revolved around four potential arguments. First, there might be differences in the geographical distribution of XMRV. Rossetti's human T lymphotropic virus type 1, HTLV-1, exhibited was relatively easy to find among Japanese populations, but less so in other Asian countries, and exceedingly rare in regions outside of Asia. Maybe XMRV was largely confined to the United States, the way Borrelia burgdorferi was the commonly accepted cause of Lyme disease in the U.S., whereas Borrelia guarinii was more common in certain parts of Europe. Second, PCR data, which was used by all three negative studies, is particularly sensitive to sequence variation. Therefore, if the viral sequence was well characterized and the regions which were conserved and did not change markedly as the virus evolved, then PCR was a good diagnostic tool. At the time, however, the genetic variation between different XMRV sequences was about 0.03%, even though they were obtained from geographically distant areas. This variation was even smaller than the differences observed in HTLV-1, a virus that did not appear to exhibit much sequence difference. Thus, there was not enough known about the sequence variation to determine whether these regions were well conserved or not, so PCR was not necessarily reliable. Third, the question of whether individuals infected with XMRV had the ability to form antibodies to the viral proteins was still unanswered. While their research had suggested patients did form antibodies to XMRV, it was still too early to use this as a reliable test, and it required the use of the spleen focus-forming antibody test as an analog. As previously noted, an antibody response could be blunted by a compromised immunity. Fourth, and perhaps most significant, the clinical criteria used by the various researchers varied dramatically, a major point given the vast arguments over the vagueness of some case definitions of ME/CFS, which easily could include cases of extremely common idiopathic chronic fatigue caused by unrelated issues such as heart failure or overwork. Patients with ME/CFS had argued for years to judge them with more stringent diagnostic standards, so they would not be lumped in with people who were simply overtired, who suffered from an obviously different ailment. The Canadian consensus criteria, after much lobbying from patients and doctors, had thus become the gold international standard for defining the ME/CFS population, as it relied not just on physical symptoms, but also highly measurable and clinical and immunological data. Mikovits and her team had used the Canadian consensus criteria, as well as abnormal chemokine and cytokine markers, to more clearly define the population and weed out unrelated illness, while other studies had seemed carelessly unconcerned with distinguishing between ME/CFS and generalized idiopathic fatigue. While the negative studies were getting the most press, other research had also been conducted during this time that supported the findings of Mikovits et al. Researchers from Germany had found XMRV sequences in the respiratory tract secretions of 2-3% of healthy donors and 10% in immune-compromised donors. The clear implication from the German research was that the immune status of individuals might be an important factor in XMRV detection. The argument Mikovits and her team made was that their paper was not simply a survey of CFS using PCR or a search for antibodies to XMRV proteins in a poorly defined group of patients. They had used several different assays for the presence of XMRV nucleic acids, proteins, and infectious virus. The research might still be challenged, but if disproving the findings involved a direct replication of the testing done by the Mikovits team, it had not been accomplished. In February 2010, Mikovits flew with the Whittemores to Washington, D.C. to visit with Senator Harry Reid. They spent the night at the historic Hay Adams Hotel, just across from Lafayette Square, with a view of the White House. The hotel was founded by John Hay, a former secretary to Abraham Lincoln, and Henry Adams, an acclaimed author and descendant of father and son U.S. presidents, John Adams and John Quincy Adams. The Whittemores and Mikovits managed to check in just before an ice storm hit the region. The storm left the trees latticed with ice, and when Mikovits stepped outside into the cold the next morning, she noted the absolute quiet that had blanketed the capital city. The ice storm had closed most of official Washington, but that didn't deter the group from making their way to the office of the Senate Majority Leader. They were on a mission to get funding for the planned institute and see if they could get it designated as a National Center of Excellence, which would make it much easier to obtain federal grants. The Whittemores' lobbyist, Alan Freemeyer, drove them to meet with Harry Reid. On the way, Freemeyer had a special stop planned for them. As they drove, Mikovits thought the neighborhood looked familiar. She pulled up to a house, and it clicked. "This is my grandfather's house," she exclaimed happily, suddenly flooded with nostalgic memories. "Where my mother was born, and where my grandfather died of cancer." Freemeyer pulled the car over, and Dr. Mikovits stepped out onto the sidewalk. She remembered all the time she'd gone there, the times she'd listened to baseball on the radio with her grandfather, and when he'd been too sick from cancer to listen. In that very house, she had made the decision to fight the disease that was stealing her beloved grandfather away. She knew she had mentioned the address, 417 Constitution Avenue, to the Whittemores in her stories about her grandfather, but didn't think they'd been listening that closely. But they had, and they were honoring her by remembering it, and taking her to the location so she could recall the young girl who so desperately wanted to fend off her grandfather's death. That young girl still lived inside Mikovits, and now she was going to visit one of the most powerful men in the country. She had come full circle, fulfilling the promise she'd made in that very house. The office of the Senate Majority Leader was almost overwhelming to Mikovits. It was elegant and radiated centuries of power. Portraits of John F. Kennedy, Andrew Jackson, and Mark Twain, whose wife, Livy Clemens, had suffered from neurasthenia, prompting Twain to write about his beloved, "She was always frail in body, and she lived upon her spirit, whose hopefulness and courage were indestructible," hung on the walls. The office was appointed with large wingback leather chairs, dark mahogany tables, the seal of the Senate, and pictures of the senator with various world dignitaries. As the group sat down to speak with the senator, a large fire crackled in his private fireplace. Reid inquired after Andrea's health with his typical concern, before they all turned to Mikovits. She began by talking about her background, her experience culturing HTLV-1, her doctoral work on HIV latency, the years she'd spent at the NCI Biological Response Modifiers Program, and in the Screening Technologies branch of the Division of Cancer Treatment, and determining which compounds and drugs might be helpful in treatment for AIDS-associated malignancies. The recent publication of the Science article was what really held his interest, and how the WPI could be designated a center of excellence to make it easier to obtain federal funding. The momentum seemed swifter than it had ever been. Mikovits mentioned how she had become aware of ME/CFS, the estimated 17 million people worldwide and 1 million in the United States who suffered from the condition, and the hellish day-to-day experience they endured. Senator Reed eased back into his chair, a finger at his lips, his eyes watching intently. She knew the look. It was one of active interest, and while he might not be following all of her points, she was convincing him of her expertise for the task of conquering this illness that was known to be more common than HIV, lung cancer, and breast cancer in women, with no small number in men and children as well, a national epidemic. When she was finished, Senator Reed's eyes darted to Harvey, then Annette. He said he saw why this was so important and wanted to help in any way he could. Reed's staff could help with any details. What more could any researcher want than to have the support of the most powerful man in Congress? Mikovits was about to enter the most perilous phase of her professional career, and by late May and early June of 2010, it would come to be viewed as the time when angels and devils revealed themselves. The publication of her article in Science put Mikovits at the top of the list of speakers for the 5th Invest in ME conference in London on May 24, 2010, and she was slated to be the final speaker for the day. When she had attended the year before, she'd been blown away by the keynote address of journalist Hillary Johnson with her speech, The Why, that recounted in vivid detail not just what it felt like to have ME/CFS, but the manipulation and mismanagement of the disease by the CDC, starting with the 1984 to 1985 Incline Village outbreak. A year after that conference, Mikovits had become friends with Johnson, and she shared with the journalist much of the inside drama of what had taken place since the publication of the Science paper. The paper had come under some attack from the negative studies, but researchers at the conference were still enthusiastic about XMRV and what it might mean for the treatment of ME/CFS. During the conference, Mikovits and Annette Whittemore got the opportunity to have several long talks with Cheney about the research. Cheney had more of a research bent than Peterson, and the theory of a retroviral origin for ME/CFS could reasonably be credited to him during his early presence at the 1984 to 1985 Incline Village outbreak. He had also worked with Dr. Elaine DeFreitas, who in the 1990s had published evidence of a retrovirus in the disease, but then had come under vicious attack. A 1996 Newsweek review of Johnson's book, Osler's Web, depicted the eerie deja vu of an arrogant CDC that seemed capable of unfairly skewing retroviral replication studies on ME/CFS again in the future. When the CDC publishes a paper saying it has been unable to replicate her findings, her support evaporates. By early 1995, the saga has cost Dr. Paul Cheney and Dr. David Bell their marriages, and a regretful DeFreitas fears her career as a scientist is finished. The book closes with the image of an infectious disease spreading unchecked as an arrogant medical establishment looks the other way. Cheney had long ago parted ways with Peterson and moved to North Carolina to open his own practice, while also devoting a significant amount of time to research. Mikovits was impressed with Cheney's intelligence. The WPI was looking for a medical director, as they'd long planned to open a treatment center in August of 2010. Peterson had resigned earlier that spring. That left an opening for a medical director, one who could step in and immediately understand the complexities of the disease as well as the patient population. Cheney expressed interest in the position, assuming they were able to get the clinic up and running. For Mikovits, landing somebody with Cheney's background, intelligence, and credentials was a coup after what had been a rough couple of months. They were going to win this fight and offer hope to beleaguered patients. Cheney had been there for the beginning of the battle, and they all planned to keep fighting. A reporter for the Chicago Tribune, Trina Suderos, contacted the WPI after learning that Mikovits was scheduled to speak at the Autism One conference in Chicago. This was the same event Nobel Prize winner Luc Montagnier would attend 2 years later, leading to a scientific reprimand by his old rival Robert Gallo. The Whittemores discussed the merits of Mikovits responding to Suderos with the WPI Public Relations Company. They decided that Suderos could submit her questions in writing, Mikovits would answer them, and then the public relations consultants would review them before sending them back to Suderos. But after hearing that Paul Cheney was willing to come on board as medical director, and having spent her life as a scientist telling the truth as best she saw it, Mikovits decided to email Suderos directly from the plane from London. Trina Suderos was not held in high regard among many of the regular attendees of the annual Autism One convention in Chicago. Many years around the time of the conference, articles by her would be published questioning some new therapy or research being investigated by the autism parents. The larger questions of what might be causing the disease or whether the federal response to the epidemic was adequate rarely found their way into her articles. Prior to working for the Chicago Tribune, Suderos wrote for People magazine. She later left the Chicago Tribune in September of 2012 to become the healthcare media director for Golan Harris International, a communications firm, serving such clients as Dow Chemical, GlaxoSmithKline, and Merck Pharmaceuticals. To Dr. Mikovits, it seemed as if Suderos had already written the article in her head prior to even speaking with her. The article ran in the June 7, 2010 edition of the Tribune. Entitled, Hope Outrunning Science on Chronic Fatigue Syndrome, it painted a picture of Mikovits as an out-of-control scientist. Mikovits said she accepted an invitation to speak at Autism One to help sound the alarm. She accused researchers and government agencies of being more interested in previously published research linking XMRV and a form of prostate cancer than in her work. So, research dollars will go for XMRV-infected men with cancer, but not women with CFS, she wrote in an email. This left me no recourse but to play the autism card. Will they ignore the children too? Mikovits was known for not mincing words, but she'd never perceived herself as a public figure before. In the right context, such outspokenness could shake people up and mobilize them to create change. But in the fray of a politically sensitive scientific discovery, with ramifications that reverberated out to cancer, ME/CFS, multiple sclerosis, and the nuclear issue of autism and vaccines, such outspokenness could cause a cataclysm. While in Chicago, Mikovits and Harvey Whittemore met with Dr. Marcus Conant, a well-known AIDS researcher, and Dr. Joseph Burascano, a Lyme disease specialist, to discuss putting them in touch with a wealthy benefactor who owned a diagnostic company and was interested in developing an XMRV diagnostic test. Conant was a legend in the AIDS community, having first identified Kaposi's sarcoma in AIDS patients as an associate professor at UCSF, then developing some of the most used HIV medications and helping to found the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, which had served as a steady anchor through the darkest years of the AIDS epidemic. As an advocate, he was the successful lead plaintiff in a case that claimed the First Amendment protected the right of physicians to recommend the use of medical marijuana to people living with HIV and AIDS. Burascano, as an expert on Lyme and tick-borne co-infections, had testified before Congress on his areas of expertise. At one point in the meeting, a call came in on Harvey's cell phone. He listened for a few moments and then exclaimed, "She did what?" Suderos had apparently shared with the WPI what she was planning to publish, and the WPI was going into overdrive to try and limit the damage. Though apologetic, Mikovits felt the entire situation was unfair, that she should be able to talk freely, that it was an absolute necessity for scientific investigation, and most scientists did not come under this level of scrutiny. Yet she knew that it was reasonable to vet public comments through their PR firm. Harvey said, "We love you, warts and all, Judy, but don't talk to anybody without our permission." When Mikovits first made her plans to speak at Autism One, shortly after she'd spoken at the Defeat Autism Now conference in January of 2010, there had not been much media attention on her. As the spotlight increased, Annette expressed misgivings about Mikovits going to Autism One. They discussed it, and Mikovits said she was going because she had given her word. Even though Mikovits planned to go with the full knowledge of Harvey and Annette, they tried to limit her exposure there. Normally, at Autism One, every talk was recorded and the entire conference then placed on a DVD so that parents and professionals could review it. Her talk would not be recorded. Hillary Johnson accompanied her to the conference, and together they walked the halls and commented on what they saw. They both felt that the community of parents in autism were much better organized than the ME/CFS patient community. But they also agreed the research conducted on autism was woefully lacking. Mikovits's talk was on the program at the same time as another presentation by the editors and writers for the website Age of Autism, founded by Dan Olmsted, who had been an editor for 25 years with United Press International, as well as USA Today, and Mark Blaxill, a Harvard MBA who ran his own consulting company. One of the writers for Age of Autism, this book's co-author, Kent Heckenlively, had become interested in the XMRV story from the autism angle and had talked to Mikovits several times. "Welcome to the Rebel Alliance," Dan Olmsted said in his opening remarks, referencing Star Wars, then introduced the various editors and writers for Age of Autism. The small room was packed, so after he stood up in front of the group of about 300, Heckenlively raced out of the room to Mikovits's presentation, where the audience of some 30 spectators was dwarfed by a cavernous ballroom. Heckenlively listened to the talk, then joined the small group of people huddled around Mikovits to ask questions. As he waited for his chance to talk to Mikovits, Heckenlively saw something that set off warning bells in his head. Hillary Johnson was wearing a press badge for Discover magazine. In January, the magazine had published its 100 Top Stories of 2009. The research linking XMRV to ME/CFS was ranked a respectable number 55. The number one science news story of 2009, according to Discover magazine, ahead of stem cells, swine flu, or even the discovery of the first Earth-like planet orbiting another star, was "Vaccine Phobia Becomes a Public Health Threat." For parents like Heckenlively, who had seen their children regress into autism after a vaccination, the wholesale dismissal of their observations as a phobia was like waving a red cape in front of an angry bull. He immediately felt combative toward Johnson, briefly considering grabbing her by the scruff of the neck and tossing her out of the nearest exit, but when he introduced himself, she surprised him, saying, "Oh, you're one of the people I'd been hoping to meet here." She said before the conference she had reviewed the articles on Age of Autism and had come away thinking that the two people she wanted to meet were Katie Wright, the woman whose parents had founded Autism Speaks, and him. "I thought you'd be the best person to understand XMRV in the autism community," Johnson told the stunned Heckenlively. "You know they're going to come after you, don't you?" Heckenlively said to Mikovits at dinner that night with Johnson. Mikovits explained that she had taken precautions by gathering strong scientific and political support, and that new findings that upset old paradigms were often the subject of heated attacks. She felt safe keeping her nose to the grindstone and focusing on science. "But you talked about autism and vaccines," he answered. "You've got yet another bullseye on your back. No offense to your XMRV discovery, but it was story number 55 in Discover Magazine's Top 100 Stories of 2009 and told with neutral language. The anti-vaccine parents were number one. In their eyes, we're the same enemy." "I really haven't joined the anti-vaccine campaign," she protested. "I think vaccines have by and large been a good thing. It's just that in some people, they may have negative effects." "That's what we all say at first," continued Hecken lively. "We say we understand that vaccines have done wonderful things, but may cause problems in a subgroup of people. We politely ask, won't you please look at this question so we can continue to vaccinate safely? Then we got attacked for being anti-science when all we wanted was more science for our kids. I have a child who can't speak, and I want answers." Hecken lively told the story of his own children. His daughter, Jacqueline, had been born without complications and developed normally for the first 6 months of life. She'd gone off breast milk at 6 months, starting a cow's milk-based formula, and a few weeks later got her six-month series of shots. During this time, she also had a series of ear infections and received 6 rounds of antibiotic treatments. The decline in her had been gradual, and she wasn't diagnosed with a seizure disorder until about 4 months later. "I'd heard about the vaccine theory for problems with these kids around that time," Hecken lively continued. "It just seemed so unbelievable. I actually remember telling people, shit happens, and that unfortunately something terrible had simply happened to my daughter with her seizures and autism. Then came my son, Ben, and he made me a believer. Ben was born without complications, and from the very start was so active he was nicknamed Busy Ben. Hecken lively's wife's family had a history of milk allergies, and amidst all of the problems with Jacqueline, they uncovered a milk allergy. When Ben went off breast milk, his parents gave him a hypoallergenic milk formula until he was about 15 months old. But it was expensive, and since their son was doing so well, they figured it didn't justify the extra cost." Hecken lively's voice became softer and more intense as he continued Ben's story. "I took Ben to his 18-month checkup in early January. I'd given the pediatrician hell because I thought she might have missed something at my daughter's 6-month checkup years earlier. They were on the lookout for problems with my kids, so they put Ben through an entire developmental milestones series of tests. He passed with flying colors. He had 15 or 20 words, looked at the doctor, and was very engaged. They gave him his shots, and we left. Within a few days of getting vaccinated, Ben became mute. On Martin Luther King Day in 2001, Kent was in a bookstore and ran across the book Unraveling the Mystery of Autism and Pervasive Developmental Disorder by Karen Cerusi. The book presented the theory that a diet free of wheat and dairy, gluten and casein, might help children with autism and other developmental disorders. Both Ben and Jacqueline went on the diet the following day. For Jacqueline, it did little, but for Ben, it had a profound effect. Ben started the diet within 5 days of going mute, and after 7 days of the diet, he spoke his first word again. "I'll never forget it as long as I live," Hecken lively told the two women. "We were outside the Nordstrom's department store in Walnut Creek, where there's a small fountain and a pillar with a lion's head on each side with water coming out of the lion's mouth into the small pool. Ben was fascinated by this stream of water going into the pool. He looked like he was focusing all of his attention, everything he had inside of him, and then he just said, 'Bubbles.' He kept saying it again and again, and my wife and I were laughing and encouraging him to keep saying it, and he did." Heckenlively related how his wife Linda, a speech therapist trained in the steps of language acquisition, observed in the months that followed as Ben slowly regained the language he had lost. It took about a year for him to catch up with his developmental age for speech, and about 2 years for what seemed to be a painful sound sensitivity to subside, but by the time he started kindergarten, he was just like any neurotypical kid. I was able to reverse something in my son that I wasn't able to do with my daughter. She's 12 years old now and can't speak. Someday I want to have a conversation with her. That's why I'm doing all of this. You will have that conversation someday, Mikovits reassured him. Promise? Said Heckenlively. Yes. Okay, I'm going to hold you to it, Doc. Someday I will have a conversation with my daughter. For Heckenlively, it was all so clear. Even though she didn't fully realize it, Mikovits had already joined the Rebel Alliance. The next day, Hillary Johnson and Kent Heckenlively met for breakfast. Heckenlively thought it hilarious that the same Discover magazine that had Vaccine Phobia as its number one science story of the previous year would send such a sympathetic journalist to the Autism One conference who would seek him out. Johnson told Heckenlively that some people with ME/CFS also traced the onset of their symptoms to a vaccination, just as Andrea Whittemore had traced her relapse to the MMR shot required before she could start at the University of Nevada, Reno. Heckenlively wondered how he could talk so candidly about these issues with a world-famous scientist like Mikovits and a top-notch journalist like Johnson, while the press seemed to take an almost ghoulish delight in painting the parents as fanatics and the scientists as the voices of reason. While Mikovits understood why Heckenlively might be worried about her future, there were a few things he didn't know that made her believe things would soon move in a more positive direction. Something that could be cited as evidence of possible contamination in the XMRV study was the lack of sequence diversity between known isolates of the virus. The less diversity in the virus, the more likely studies using the Silverman strain were subject to contamination. But Frank Rossetti's collaborator at the NCI, Dr. Kathy Jones, the scientist who replaced Mikovits when she left Rossetti's lab to head the lab of antiviral drug mechanisms, had been doing work on the sequence diversity of the virus. They were finding different strains of the virus and greater diversity than they had seen previously. Diversity is our friend, Mikovits and Rossetti would often say to each other. The same weekend Mikovits attended the Autism One conference, the Cold Springs Harbor conference on retrovirology, where presentations on XMRV a year earlier had caused the NCI to hold the invitation-only meeting to discuss public health threat of XMRV, was held. At the Cold Springs Harbor Conference, Jones discovered another group, led by Dr. Harvey Alter, chief of the Infectious Disease Section in the Department of Infectious Disease at the National Institutes of Health, and his collaborator, Dr. Shai-Shing Lo, had been doing similar research. Alter was best known for his discovery of the hepatitis C virus, for which he received both the Distinguished Service Medal, the highest award that can be given to civilians working in the U.S. government, and the Lasker Award for clinical medical research. The Alter-Low paper showed significantly more sequence variation in XMRV than had previously been reported, thus lowering the possibility that the findings of Mikovits and her team were due to contamination. They were finally being backed by solid supporters. Kathy Jones learned that Alter and Lowe's study had already been submitted to the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Although Jones felt her own paper had more data about the sequence variation, it would be good politics to let Alter and Lowe publish their findings first, since they had no ties to the original XMRV study. If all things went as planned, Alter and Lowe's paper would come out within a few weeks of the Cold Springs Harbor meeting. Back at the WPI, Mikovits hosted Marcus Conant, the AIDS doctor. As an AIDS veteran, Conant was known for forceful advocacy and would later tell those working in ME/CFS that they needed to proactively create their own luck without waiting for either the press or the government to understand their work. Conant shared with Mikovits his hope and determination that XMRV would not be subject to the same government indifference that held back HIV/AIDS research for several years. Conant strongly believed that Mikovits should get a lawyer to protect herself and the WPI against legal challenges, which were likely to start flying. Those who had been on the front lines of the AIDS fight had come to expect heavy adversity. Conant had an attorney in mind, a man around 70 years old like himself, and he picked up the phone with Mikovits present. "Hey, buddy," Conant said. "What if I were to tell you this scenario? Some researchers found a virus and the government says it doesn't exist, yet they have a serology test that can distinguish it and prove it's there. What would that sound like to you?" Even though she couldn't hear his answer, the bemused expression on Conant's face told her what the answer had been. The new discovery sounded just like HIV/AIDS.